In the last issue, a real American hero was locked up in a mothballed military base for a crime he didn't commit. Under attack from the forces of Major Blood, he escaped from the pit. Today, still wanted by the government, Duke is tracking down the source of the robot menace to take his revenge. If you have a killer robot problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find him, maybe you can hire Duke.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, coming to you live and direct from the Energon universe once again with Duke 4 and 5. If you are new to Talking Joe, you can find out all of the details at the website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. Now, as I said, today indeed we will be looking at the grand finale to the Duke miniseries covering issues 4 and 5, which were released 27th of March and 24th of April 2024. As always, there will be spoilers ahead. Joining me once again to talk all about it, it's a real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
How are you doing, Tim?
I am doing well. We had a few weeks without getting together, you and I, and recording episodes, so it's nice
to
be...
Yeah, not that the listeners would have known that due to my impeccable timing and scheduling of episodes coming out.
yes, so not so much for listeners, but it's nice to be sitting at my microphone again and hearing you on the other end.
Stuff. As the our interview with Kickley came out just in the last week, we've also sort of put out there into the world a commission that Kickley did of yourself and me in amongst some pack rats, Tim. What did you think when you saw that?
I chuckled out loud because you are starting to gather together a small but concerted collection of commissioned art of us two for Talking Joe, and I'm tickled by that. Also, how did you and Kickley know my favorite pack rat was the one with the missiles?
I think you could probably chuck a dart at the pack rats and have a fairly good percentage chance of hitting the right one, right?
Yeah. Yes. But I also find that image fun because I feel like it's unusual in a commission for someone that someone is lying on their back as mm-hmm. if, you know, like fixing something under the hood of a car or under a car. So that's a fun compositional difference between the two Talking Joe hosts in that drawing. I also appreciate that we are new characters and also kind of like 2024 classified, like new recruits, because we've got somewhat General Green, you know? It's not like I'm not cosplaying as a character and you're not cosplaying as a character. We're sort of our own new Joes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, most of the decisions taken on that piece were by Kickley himself. I basically said something with me and Tim, trying to have everything going off so that we're in the thick of things. But, you know, beyond that, up to you. And he chose what we'd be wearing, the vehicles and any other characters involved. So yeah, very little art direction from me there.
I look forward to more and more images of just us that push all the images of past Talking Joe hosts lower and lower on the website.
Very good. Tim, I had a sort of an update on something we were talking about in our last episode of Duke, where we were talking about the origins of Baroness's new file name, Anastasia Sisarovna. So historically, DeCobre was the prevalent name that was used for her, but in the pages of Duke, this different name was used. And I actually tracked the first appearance back with, I think it was Greg Augustin gave me a tip-off to this one. And the first use of that name was America's Elite, issue 22, Sins of the Mother, which ironically is going to be one of the next issues that we read when we get to the Devil's Due era once again. And that was April 2007. I asked Mike O'Sullivan about that, the editor of the book, and he remembered it as being Mark Power's creation. He said that he liked to give him choice to create names and often came up with good ones. So mystery solved, I think, Tim. We can credit Mark Powers on America's Elite as the originator of that name.
That's some good sleuthing and crowdsourcing, info sourcing, Mark.
Now, today we are talking about Duke issues 4 and 5. It's coming to us from the creative team of writer Joshua Williamson, artist Tom Riley, colorist Jordi Belair, letterer Russ Wooten, editors Sean Makowitz and Jonathan Manning, and logo and publication design Andre Juarez, with production from Gillian Crabb and Richard Mercado.
Can I say just one quick thing about the credits?
Yep.
I know we have tipped our hat in this direction before, but I was really struck in the last month that this was the switch in Duke 4. One of the special thanks at Hasbro is Michael Kelly. And in issue 5 of Duke, that name is no longer there because Michael Kelly is no longer with Hasbro, and he has recently announced some new projects on Facebook, and we continue to wish him well, but I just wanted to one more time acknowledge that he has done so much for G.I. Joe and Transformers and other Hasbro publishing and storytelling, and so much of this Energon Universe relaunch was on his watch, and so many decisions would have been him or him in collaboration with Skybound people.
Indeed. And again, wishing Michael Kelly success with his new company, which he has called Extensive Enterprises. So G.I. Joe very much still in his heart.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
So, Tim, do you want to talk to us about these covers?
Yeah. Duke number 4, cover A, which is both drawn and colored by Tom Riley, which, by the way, folks, there will be two versions of the Duke graphic novel collection, the trade paperback. Huh. One version will have the cover from issue 1. And the other version, I think this is the direct market exclusive, and I think they're doing this with the Cobra Commander collection and the Duke collection. The cover to Duke issue number 4 is the other choice. And as a fan, I think it's fun to be able to choose. As a store owner ordering, it's just like regular variant covers where I guess if one isn't good, I can order the other. But I always sort of worry that someone has seen, let's say, the cover to the Duke collection, and it's one of the images, and they come into my store, and we have the other, and they're confused, or they don't see what they're looking for, and then they don't purchase it, or they don't ask. And it's just so much easier, as much as Americans like a lot of choices, and capitalism relies on it. It's just easier if the Duke collection has just one cover.
But worst outcome, I think, would be buying two of the same thing by accident, because these...
Yes. But also, you know, if you look online, there may only be one of these two images, particularly if, as I think I'm remembering correctly, the variant is only for comic book stores. And so, you know, you go to one comic book store and they have one, you go to another. Anyway, but good news, everyone. Tom Riley's cover to Duke issue 4 is one of the greatest G.I. Joe covers ever drawn. It is so exciting and fun. It compositionally has so much going for it. It is bold. There's a strong diagonal through it from the top left to the bottom right because of the explosion and then the rocky ground. It has foreground and middle ground and background. It has recognizable characters. It acts like a pinup, like, you know, Batman, quote, just on a gargoyle, or some of the other Energon Universe covers so far where, you know, it's a character with an explosion behind them. But there is story here, not much. But these five characters are fighting someone or vying for something. There's, you know, there's sort of the escape with the motorcycle in the background. There's the explosion that something's going wrong, that there's someone attacking them or they're running from an explosion. Even the water tower, which is such a interesting, because I don't think water towers show up anywhere in this 5-issue miniseries. That's not a silhouette of a G.I. Joe vehicle or a Cobra vehicle or the Bloodhounds rappelling down from a helicopter. It's not a sort of a Cobra logo. It's not a menacing Destro face. It's just something that says kind of where we are. Anyway, also, every so often, I love an image with just a really strong horizontal, and a lot of comics artists try to avoid that because that can flatten an image. And, you know, when we're in fifth grade, I think we're sort of taught, seventh grade, we're sort of taught to try to make characters, you know, have more dynamic poses than just drawing things in profile. But every so often, a profile shot sure is effective. And man, is there power in Roadblock and Stalker just in profile in the bottom. Okay, so that's great. Cover B for Duke 4 is drawn by Andre Bresson, who will be drawing the Destro miniseries, colored by Adriano Lucas. This is Duke upside down, head and shoulders, chained up with chains, no background, but sort of a wall with some, you know, spotlight and shadow. And then in the foreground, all in reds, Baroness's fist holding a knife and her face reflected in it. This is a fun cover. Cover C for Duke number 4 is another 110 ratio variant drawn by Tyler Boss. This continues the connecting images we've seen so far of jumping out of the building, driving along the road, rushing through the base. This one now is making an escape on a sort of a mountain road. Cover D is drawn by Torin Clark, who... Did Torin Clark do the covers for Silver Surfer Ghost Light, that miniseries written by John Jennings last year? This one is Major Blood with the Hector Garrido toy package style explosion back. He is holding a bunch of dog tags and a pistol. The pistol's smoking. The camera is sort of at mid-thigh height, and we're slightly looking up at him. And he's looking up, so we can see his underjaw.
Yeah, looking up with his two eyes.
Yes, yes. And then the 1 in 50 cover is drawn by Ben Oliver. It's Duke standing sort of still and straight with a machine gun, an orange background of... sort of nondescript rocks or mountains in the distance with a dramatic white for the top half of the background, and in the foreground, two black silhouettes of fists holding swords. Are there any retailer exclusives that you want to call out for Duke 4?
No retailer exclusives for 4 or 5. A fun fact, though, I think I might have been the first person to ask Ben Oliver to draw a G.I. Joe sketch.
When was that?
This was a few years back at a comic convention in Brighton, and he drew me a Baroness in my sketchbook.
Cool. You gave him a little early practice on this on this popular brand. Duke number 5, cover A. Again, I also want to call out something that I like about Tom Riley's A covers, that he is both drawing and also coloring. And I say this in a good way. I didn't know that these covers weren't colored by Jordi Belair, who colors the interiors, which is to say, either they both have a similar sense of how to color this artwork, the artist himself or the color artist who's been hired to do the interiors, or they're working together, or Belair's looking at Riley's covers and saying, maybe I'll do a little of that for the interior, or maybe Riley is looking at Belair's interiors and saying, I'm going to make the covers look sort of like these interiors. So it's just a nice match. There's a nice consistency there. The cover to issue 5A has a really striking black silhouette of a cobra bat claw taking up the top two thirds. And Duke, knees bent, hunched forward, eyes squinty, mouth open, holding one fist and the other holding a knife, ready to attack this bat that we can only see its claw. Compositionally, Duke's head and shoulders are in the negative space inside the claw. So if you hold your hand out, you know, like you're making the letter C, that's where his head and shoulders are. And then, this is great, just red background. Mm. No wall, no rocks, no sky. Sometimes covers just really pop, both in my hands and also on a shelf, begging to be bought when there isn't a background and there's just a big swath of color. And boy, does this cover read when you look at a tiny preview of it on your computer or phone.
And Mark's juvenile observation here is it does look a little bit like Duke is crying out in pain from a giant nipple clamp.
Hmm. Cover B is drawn by, both drawn and colored by Matthias Santoluco, who has done killer work on IDW's Ninja Turtles comics for the last... 10 years, the Secret History of the Foot Clan miniseries, the Shredder in Hell miniseries, the running right now Untold Destiny of the Foot Clan miniseries, which is about Karai, and issues of the regular monthly Turtles in between. This is a guy who 5 years ago I thought at IDW, oh gosh, could this guy do some G.I. Joe? He did do a variant cover for IDW's G.I. Joe 250. So this is not his first G.I. Joe work, and I think he may have done a variant for 275 with Dawn and old-fashioned Snake Eyes. So this cover is Duke in the middle ground. Behind him, some, you know, tech glowing screen and mechanical factory wall. So blue, green, yellow. Duke is lit entirely by the red forge, or I guess according to the story, battery charger. And a bat is being sort of lifted out of it by a mechanical arm. You don't have to worry about the mechanical arm. The bat is slightly underlit itself by the yellow at its feet, but also just the red of the smoke. So this color, this cover has these two really dominant swaths of color. There's the blue computer screen light on the left, and there's the red in the foreground. Around the bat. Duke's got his machine gun somewhat trained on the bat, but he's got a reaction on his face of surprise, like, what is this that is coming toward me? Very cool cover. The final of the five connecting 1 in 10 variants drawn by Tyler Boss, colored by Jason Wordle. Wordy?
And a reminder that the original art for the connecting covers measures a whopping 55 inches.
Yes, because that must mean it's drawn on 11 by 17, five of them placed next to each other.
Mm.
All right, so this is Tyler Boss and Jason Wordy. Duke is in a jetpack flying toward us, black long sleeve shirt, green pants. He's over a forest. In the background, he's flying away from a burning and crashing Cobra helicopter, which seems sort of based on the Aspid, would you say? If the Aspid and the Mamba had a baby.
Maybe.
Still one rotor blade. The cover, I'm not quite sure what time of day this takes place at. The blue of the sky, it's this sort of flat color all around. The blue of the sky could suggest daytime. It could also suggest, I don't know, 5 p.m. But unlike the previous four, where Duke is very small and it feels sort of video game side-scrollery, this is Duke flying toward us in a jetpack, and he takes up a full quarter, maybe third, of the cover. The 1 in 25 variant is drawn by Brian Level, and it is a Cobra bat with the toy package style explosion back. Many of the toy style explosion back variant covers so far, it was Steve Epting who drew the first two for Cobra Commander 1 and Duke Number 1. And I feel like just about all the other ones since then, if you squinted, you might think Steve Epting had also drawn them. They all kind of matched in style, sort of a smooth digital color or digital painting. This one by Brian Level feels much more drawn, like comics, pencils, and inks.
Yeah.
There's just sort of a lot more activity to the inking and less sort of refined smoothness. So I like it. It doesn't quite match if you're looking for a match. And then the 1 in 50 cover is drawn by Dustin Nguyen. That's spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N, who's best known for drawing Ascender and Descender at Image and a bunch of Batman and Detective projects in the last 15 years. This one is Duke in black with a AK-47 in the foreground, being menaced by a cobra bat. There's a lot of sort of smoke or steam around them. There's an interesting abstracted geometric assembly taking up the top two-thirds of the cover, which it's just white shapes, black shapes, and red shapes, which I think suggests walls in a not a regular rectangular hallway, but maybe sort of a triangular trapezoidal hallway. But then also a ceiling with, I don't know, red skylights or red lights. And then a somewhat transparent looming Destro head and red cowl, as if he's not physically there. It's not a hologram, but, you know, his presence is there. I like this cover. I don't know. I don't think it's Wynn's strongest work. I appreciate what he's doing here. I think I'm aware of its various parts, and I don't know that they fully come together. But really neat attempt. Also, I think error detected. The bat has a right hand that is a five-fingered hand, and its left hand has been replaced with the machine gun or the flamethrower.
This can be sort of explained away relatively easily, that the go-to design for the Energon universe are the classified designs, and the bat design on the previous cover on D is very much the classified bat there. And on that toy, both hands are interchangeable.
So. Whoa. Okay, so the attachments can go on either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I did not know that because I do not have a classified bat.
Yeah, I got mine. I got mine out. I got mine out this today, because of the reading and having a little look and comparing and contrasting and pulling off his hands.
Do you
which
have
always gives me a little bit of nervousness about?
You're often so kind in letting me just talk about the covers. Is there any one of these covers that most jumps out at you, or one that you wanted to get and can't?
Yeah, to some degree, I think it's a shame when one of my more favorite artists does one of these rarer covers, because you can't really so easily get that in an affordable way. And again, for both of these, outside of the Tom Riley, I probably would have picked the cover E, because I am a fan of Ben Oliver and have met him a few times, and also a fan of Dustin Nguyen, who really like his work on Ascender and Descender that you talked about, as well as some of his other work. As you say, I don't know that this is necessarily his strongest work ever, but in terms of collecting an artist that I'm fan of their work, it would probably be those two.
Speaking of artists doing variant covers for the Energon universe at Skybound, issue 7, I think it's issue 7 of Transformers, has a variant by Alex Milne, M-I-L-N-E, defining Transformers artist of a generation for working not just at Dreamwave, but also IDW. And he wrapped up the IDW continuity by drawing the epic Unicron miniseries, and then some of the Transformers, the bold new universe, the Brian Ruckley arc run. And here he is doing a cover for now a third Transformers publisher, and such that Skybound has been interested in not hiring the artists from the past publisher to draw these books. But we are starting to see some covers here and there by artists who have contributed to these brands in publishing before.
So back into the world of G.I. Joe's story. Last time on Duke, we left Duke as the American hero who's gone on the crusade to unravel the mystery of the giant flying robot that killed his friend. He was framed for a crime he didn't commit, taken to a mothballed base, the Pit, where he was attacked by Major Blood and his bloodhounds. Free from his cell, Duke found himself at the mercy of his fellow prisoner, the Baroness. And that is where the story picks up in issue 4. And let's talk about 4 and 5 in a plot breakdown.
Plot breakdown.
As Major Blood's bloodhound mercenaries continue their assault on the Pit, Duke is at the mercy of the Baroness, who is threatening to cash in on the price on Duke's head. Duke is able to talk her around and let him go. Making their way further down into the Pit, Duke uncovers decommissioned experimental vehicles. And while Major Blood staggers to the surface, clutching his wounded eye, a ramp opens, from where an APC, Mobat tank, and Skystrakers jet launch out, causing the enemy forces to scatter. In the confusion, Baroness escapes in a solo Fang helicopter. Duke flies away in the Skystriker, following his tracking signal, which takes him into the path of Scrap Iron, or more specifically, the missiles from Scrap Iron's weapon system, which takes down his jet. Duke is able to escape from his jet crash and make his way to Destro's base, where he uncovers a battle android trooper. As Duke is thrown to the floor by the robot, Destro finally reveals himself, with Duke learning that he was not behind the transforming robots that killed his friend. Duke then dukes it out with one-on-one with the bat, ripping its head from its body and using its spinal column like a club to defeat the robot. Duke's victory is fleeting as the base is detonated in a giant explosion. Later, a news broadcast reports on his death, but reports of his death are greatly exaggerated as we find him recovering in a hospital bed. Hawk fills Duke in on some details and asks that Duke build a highly trained special missions force to fight the emerging robot threat. Duke is on board with the mission to destroy them all. Dum dum dum, to be continued somewhere. Tim, high level reaction to these two issues?
Oh man, what great, fun, gorgeous, satisfying G.I. Joe comics. And, you know, as a longtime fan, this checks off a lot of boxes. As a fan aware that this is a relaunch that's really young and elements are getting introduced, reintroduced for the first time and sort of teasing them out and then making them sort of hit, so satisfying. And imagining what this might be like for first-time readers, you know, we have some of those at my store, and the letters pages refer to this as well. I think this miniseries is gorgeous and exciting and accessible and satisfying for new readers who don't really know G.I. Joe and haven't read any. So a very successful 5-issue miniseries that manages to balance some character moments, some familiar sort of reprise, introduce new elements and some sort of little left turns, a satisfying ending. And I will be so happy to sell this as a collected graphic novel. One last comparison, right? I always hesitate when someone says of a comic, this would make a great movie, because comics and movies are very different. And, you know, in America, we do this a lot. Like, oh, this book would make a great movie. Or, oh, this short story would make a great movie, as if the movie is the thing that makes it legitimate. But, well, it was a great short story or poem or comic or novel before that. Isn't that enough? Man, this would make a great G.I. Joe, a first G.I. Joe movie in a new continuity.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we're at the end of issue 5 now, so we've got these 2 issues, but we've also got the end of the series, and it does a really good job at wrapping up the kind of the story of these 5 issues in a quite satisfying way, but also leaving so much open to explore in terms of some of the things introduced here, how it ties together with the rest of the universe being introduced, and the ongoing G.I. Joe story that is kind of promised here. And the writing is great. The storytelling there is great. The lines of dialogue, really punchy and quotable. The art from Tom Riley looks fantastic. In the letters page there, Joshua Williams says, "I love Tom. He's a great partner, a great storyteller who takes what I'm writing and levels it up. The energy he brings to heat up the story and the action. I hope to work with Tom for a long time. And I hope that work involves him coming back to G.I. Joe." I really hope. And the art from Jordi Belair is incredible. The sense, comparing the black and white art to the published art, you get a sense of kind of what is being brought, that there's so much atmosphere, scene, kineticism, in that colouring, it really sort of levels it up. And even the lettering on this occasional sort of, pause and think, oh, that really works, that's great. So such a satisfying couple of issues and such a satisfying miniseries.
I just want to call out a couple of details that are examples of things you just said. In issue 4, we get the introduction of Scrap Iron, the third G.I. Joe figure I ever bought, and one of my faves. And I've always been a little sad he's not in the cartoon more, he's not in the Larry Hama comic more. And he gets to do a couple things here, and even in these 2 scenes, sort of be himself, be the character.
Yeah, Scrap Iron specific things.
Yeah. When he is unable to destroy, to kill Duke, when he shoots down the plane, he tosses his helmet in disgust. And I'm going to assume that is a Joshua Williamson script point. Riley doesn't draw the pose where he does it. He draws a POV shot where the shape of the panel is Scrap Iron's visor. So we see what he sees, and with the sort of enhanced tech of his visor. And then the next panel is that helmet hitting the ground and kicking up some dust. And arg! And you might think this might be one of the places where I say, because I call out this kind of thing on Talking Joe, well, what's actually happening here? I need the camera to back up. I need to see the pose. I did understand this, and I love it, that you don't have to show him taking his helmet off. You don't have to show him throwing his helmet, like full body pose, arm, hand, helmet. The helmet hits the ground, and then the next panel, we see him without his helmet, which is a little shocking, because he, in the classified version, not the 1984 version, 84, he's got this burn scar on his face, because presumably something exploded near him. That was him not being careful, because he's a little nuts. And so these 2 pages, just wanted to call out, okay, you've talked about lettering, right? The giant panel on the left side where the Sky Striker hits the top of a hill and then continues to go down and explode after it. And there's this giant sound effect, crash, that is in the distance behind all of the mountains and explosion and smoke. And Russ Wooten and Jordi Belair color it to almost disappear into the, what time of day is this? Dusk?
Or dusk, yeah, dusk.
You know, it's 7 p.m.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like pinkish lavender sky. In that, this is a very loud sound. So the size of the sound effect says this is a loud sound, but the treatment of it, that the color makes it almost invisible compared to the sky, says that it's muffled and or far away. And I don't know that that's in the script. I think that's just sort of a smart combination that comes from thoughtful lettering and color. And then on the page on the right side, right, there's this bit with the helmet and then their reveal of Scrap Iron. And so much is working in concert here. Like this these two pages as a example of my high points at the beginning, that this is fun and satisfying and exciting and accessible. And then on top of it, I'll say one last thing. Scrap Iron here, near the end of issue 4 on page 17 in panel 5, says, because he's just realized that he didn't kill Duke. Duke survived a crashing F-14 jet. Scrap Iron says, "What does it take to stop this guy?" And then, and I chuckled when I read that, because ... Then issue 5, Mercer says to Destro, "Does anything stop this guy? I hate to admit it, but I'm impressed." And I chuckled, is Joshua Williamson writing these two lines for Diana Davis, who is doing consulting editorial assistance for Skybound on the Larry Hama G.I. Joe book, right? Sort of a continuity cop and a check for both writing and character and art, and research assistance. And I'm not sure if she's doing any work on the Energon work books. I don't think so, because she's not credited that way. But
yeah, she said previously that she's not.
Okay. All right. So this might just be me making a funny connection for myself between two elements that are not actually connected, right? Williamson may not know of Diana Davis. Diana Davis not doing any work for this part of the Skybound's Hasbro license. But the larger thing that this speaks to here is I've always been a little wary of this idea that any one G.I. Joe character is sort of the super one, is better than the rest. And certainly Sergeant Slaughter got some of that treatment in September 86 with the 5-part miniseries Arise, Serpentor, Arise, right? Sergeant Slaughter is kind of this like superhuman in that miniseries, the way that the Joes are in awe of him, the way that Cobra uses him in the mix to make Serpentor. And I feel like that's really fun for kid me, but a little disproportionate, because I feel like even though any one Joe is an expert at their thing, sort of collectively all the Joes are the best, and there isn't one who like is sort of as good as three of them combined. And now and then in the history of G.I. Joe, I felt a little of this in the first live-action movie, Rise of Cobra, because a movie like that needs a main character, even if it's a team movie, even if it's an ensemble, right? You need the lead to sort of follow and root for. There's this idea floating around there that, like, Duke becomes the icon for a real American hero. Like, he's the leader, he's the best, he's the favorite. It's sort of like Bumblebee and Optimus Prime combined. He's like your dad and leader, but also your brother and your friend. And that's cool. I don't quite agree with it as a take on G.I. Joe. And it's okay here because this miniseries is not called G.I. Joe, it's called Duke. And we're getting to G.I. Joe. And also, Duke is amazing. And I feel like when these two villains say it, it's not being overstated. Like, Duke is doing sort of fantastic superhuman things. But I also feel like Williamson is leaving room in future G.I. Joe stories for other Joes to have similarly sort of Herculean successes, you know, like uncovering secrets, getting out of tight binds, surviving disasters like a plane crash. So I enjoy these two lines because there's a little of this like, man, everyone, can you believe how awesome Duke is? Which is a way of saying, hey, everyone, do you know how awesome the G.I. Joe brand is? And I agree. It is.
I mean, he's tenacious, but he's not infallible. So like, you know, the Joes have sort of said how they look up to him, and he's kept on going and he's seen this thing through to the end. But along the way, he's getting beaten up. He's looking, you know, quite a state. He's, you know, comes very close to death. He's got a scarred face.
He's gotten people killed.
Yeah, and you know, Dr. Burkhart and her companions have died. He's kind of jumped to the wrong conclusion about this metal robot that's killed his friend and sort of pins it on Destro when he's not involved in in that at all. And he doesn't always make great decisions. You know, he headbutts a guy wearing a metal faceplate and punches a robot in the chest with his fist.
He's wearing that modern armored glove thing. I don't know
he does, but it kind of on that panel it almost bursts, doesn't it? Right. And the bat just sort of doesn't move at all. It's when Duke headbutts Destro initially, it's a panel of like a clang. And Destro kind of responds, "Are you insane?" Sort of not fazed by it at all. And Duke has almost already got a giant bruise sort of swelling up in his forehead. And then when he punches the bat, it's kind of that kind of kinetic blurring effect on inks. There's just a very modest sound effect, took as if it, you know, it's barely fazing the bat at all. And it's kind of looking down at his fist as to say, what's that? And his glove is kind of bursting open a bit, and then they're followed up by a backhander from the bat with a very different reaction of almost the colour being knocked out of Duke and flying across the room. Very different sound effect as well. Thoom, as opposed to the tuk.
I know this is a different Duke because he's at the beginning, because his faith has been shaken, because he's investigating a conspiracy. Have we seen a Duke this stubborn? Before or this tenacious? I know those words overlap, but they're not quite the same. I feel like a little bit of this Duke is the Duke we see in the first animated miniseries. He just sort of charges in, and also in the first episode of the second miniseries, this is in 83 and 84. Both times he gets captured, and both times he's captured and on display in the Cobra Arena of Sport and has to, you know, find a way out. And he is sort of the main character of that first miniseries. There's a
parallel. Duke getting captured and sort of, as he does here, and then sort of David versus Goliath, Duke versus the Bats with the battle in the arena of sports one-on-one.
Oh, versus Ramar.
Hmm.
Because when I think of Duke in the, 300 issues of Larry Hama's G.I. Joe continuity, he is not the main character. And, you know, he shows up when it is appropriate because his toy was new. And, you know, he gets a couple spotlights. And then, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like a year or two later, he isn't showing up much because, you know, Hama's got another 15 Joes to bring in. You know, what about Flint? What about Beachhead? What about, you know, Lightfoot? And then when he might come back in naturally because of Tiger Force, he doesn't. And, you know, then when he gets some costume updates in the 90s, he comes back in. And he shows up in Trusula Bismia.
Yeah. When all of the other Joes die, and I was being put in mind of that when you were talking about sort of flying off the handle a little bit, and he was out for revenge, and you know, still in his classic costume there. So I think he has been maybe not necessarily the main character of the Joe book, but sort of definitely on the periphery, and I think in the IDW era, there's been a smaller sort of focused cast, I think, where there's been less pressure to include the latest figure being introduced as a toy, and so right. Larry's able to kind of select his favorites and favorite characters, and has in the letter pages called out that Duke has grown on him over time and has become more of a favorite, and I think definitely playing a bigger role as part of that sort of core Joe team.
Yeah, in the IDW issues of Real American Hero, we're seeing Duke often in the pit, sort of running the mission from base and coordinating with Mainframe and Psych Out. And then he gets to do a lot in the Cobra World Order special, that issue that was published between 218 and 219. That's the issue where he gives that Senator Ling Torres?
Mm-hmm.
A tour of the base, which is really a tour for new readers, because it's just status quo updates on the entire series, on all the different factions.
Yeah, and also if you think about like a couple of the main, the sort of the key covers of that era, you had 225, which was that wraparound cover, which was Duke versus Cobra Commander as like the most important character of G.I. Joe, Duke versus the most important character in Cobra. And then similarly on the cover to issue 300, that other wraparound cover by Jamie Sullivan, you also had Duke versus Cobra Commander. So, you know, there's a lot of iconography there about Duke as a significant character, one of the most significant characters.
Leading from that backwards, a step deeper, the cover to 200, which is just Duke and Cobra Commander. Mm. And as I recall, they have a good fight in that issue. And I got a letter published about that issue and how satisfying that fight was.
Yeah, that's right. On the top of the his tank, yeah.
Duke has shown up a lot in comics, but we have, you know, Master and Apprentice, Dreadnoughts, Declassified. We've gotten a little bit of this, but this phenomenon here, a Duke a character miniseries, Duke, Cobra Commander, is quite different for G.I. Joe storytelling in publishing.
Yeah, and we've got Destro and Scarlet to come, and they kind of allude to in the letter page somewhere that they think that this miniseries approach of introducing a new character via a miniseries and giving them a little bit more of a spotlight and room to breathe and you know, focus on them seems to be quite successful, and that we can probably expect that approach to be continuing in some shape or form in the future after these initial four character miniseries.
Yeah, this is not a perfect comparison, but it reminds me a little bit of how IDW launched its Transformers books after Dreamwave fell apart. There was a series of six-issue Transformers miniseries that ran for a couple of years before there was a regular monthly ongoing. And in fact, if you looked up that title in the Diamond catalog, it informally, the word ongoing, I believe, was right after the word Transformers as a way to differentiate it. And that ran for 2 years, and there were some miniseries along the way. And then that ongoing monthly sort of relaunched and split as two different monthly ongoings, each with a different focus. But, you know, sort of, I think in the back of our minds, older fans are always comparing this to Marvel in the 80s when there's just the one Transformers monthly and just the one G.I. Joe monthly and sort of a little bit of spinoffs, you know, Transformers Headmasters 4-issue miniseries, G.I. Joe Special Missions spinoff series that initially was every other month. But, you know, the market is so different now, and, you know, this is such a fun and smart way to, you know, you just look at all these covers and it's really obvious. Who's this about? You know, G.I. Joe, who's this about? I don't know. Duke, who's this about? I think this is about Duke. And you know, smartly, none of the A covers of Duke didn't have Duke. Yep. You know, it wasn't like one cover is like the Baroness and Destro, you know, in like a cool, fun pinup. It's like Duke punching, Duke grappling, Duke, you know, putting up his dukes.
Speaking of Diana Davis, she met David Mack at a Comic Con not long ago and was able to hold in her hands the original art to Duke issue one. The cover art. And by doing so, revealed that actually that David Mack illustration for number one, which was Baroness with then sort of a floating head of Duke in the background, had the Duke floating head as a separate independent illustration, which was stitched together digitally later. So it may well have been that the original illustration was just a solo Baroness, and possibly there could have been an editorial poke to integrate Duke into that image as well, given it was, I think, yeah, Duke issue one.
Yeah, certainly, you know, like some of these variants have just had, you know, Destro or Major Blood, or even in today's episode, a Cobra Bat on the cover. You know, that's totally fine, because a random customer is not wandering into a comic book store and buying Duke number 5, the, you know, 1 in 10 or 1 in 25 reissue variant by accident, you know, because that's going to be marked up and there's probably going to be a sticker on it saying what it is.
We were talking about sort of the fallibility of Duke, you know, against his some of the almost super heroic elements of him being this sort of bigger than life character, bigger than other Joes potentially. The way that this, I'm jumping right to the end of the story here, but after Duke has had this epic battle with the bats and before the explosion, he says, "I got you, Frost," referring back to his co-pilot that was killed by Starscream all the way back in issue pages of Transformers and recapped in issue one. And that's almost like a sense of resolution, you know, mission accomplished. I'll set out for revenge to sort of get some payback for my fallen comrade and friend. And, you know, I've beaten that bat, so I can lie on the ground and knowing that I've unpicked it and you know, I can almost die happy knowing that I've done that. But of course, the reality is that he didn't get payback at all. You know, it was Starscream that did it, and he went off on this completely separate quest to track down Destro, which is entirely separate to how Frost died back in issue one.
Yeah, I also noted that Frost is mentioned two or three times here in issues 4 and 5, and I had forgotten that we learned that person's name back in that issue of Transformers in the first issue of Duke. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, this is a new made up guy who can just get offed. Do I want that to be someone we know? That would be more satisfying. Oh, but then they're offing a character that I know and love before they get to do anything. And I sort of wondered while reading these two issues of Duke, will any future stories show a flashback with Duke and this character? Will we get to know him a little bit? Will he sort of retroactively get to be sort of like a G.I. Joe that wasn't, you know, like, I can't remember if Frost is his code name or his last name. And I understand that Frost exists before there is a G.I. Joe team. There's no reason for him to actually sort of be a G.I. Joe or was going to maybe kind of be a G.I. Joe. But to the extent that he is such a motivating character, though he does so little, he has such a presence in this story and he's named several times. And I thought, yeah, I sort of wonder if there'll be an issue later where, you know, there's like a 2-page flashback where Duke says that he, you know, was on a mission like when they first met or something. And I'm sure if that were to happen several episodes from now in Talking Joe, I'd say something like, "Mark, why is this writer having a flashback with Duke and a non-player character? Make it a flashback about when Duke and Clutch used to go on adventures or whatever, you know, like use a marquee character."
I mean, that would advance a surviving character's story as well. Here's another thing of Duke going off maybe in the wrong direction after you know, deciding that he's got his payback for his friend by getting that bat. He's shown a picture of Optimus Prime as and kind of to illustrate that there's more than just one transforming robot causing havoc, and this big SOB turns into a truck. Despero might not have built them, but someone did. We need to know what they are, how to stop them. And Duke's conclusion, we destroy them all. So again, Duke maybe not quite on the right path, vowing to destroy all Transformers and particularly the hero, the good guy, Optimus Prime.
Yeah, this ending, it's fun to see Tom Riley draw an Autobot.
With Megatron's arm as well, sort of giving us a sense of that sort of tying into to the events of the main Transformers story again. Just as I guess issue one was a springboard from Transformers, that this is also sort of harkening back to kind of the events of the current issue Transformers.
Four, yeah, issue 4 or 5, whatever it is. I'm really struck by the negative and vengeful note that this miniseries ends on. And I don't say that in a bad way. I was sort of surprised. I don't know how I expected it to end. I didn't think that the team was, or the team was going to get defined or formed at the end of this miniseries. I thought it would come a little later. I thought there'd be sort of either more on the run and a second mission to learn more, to bump up against more Cobra agents, or, you know, to find some other Transformer that we haven't seen yet. It's perfectly reasonable that the team gets defined in the final pages of issue 5 here. And then the team sort of comes together, you know, and they're digging out the pit. But this final panel surprises me for two reasons. One, it's not celebratory, and because it is a dark negative tone that it ends on. We destroy them all. Not like, it's not even we've got our work cut out for us as a final word balloon, or thanks to all of you for sticking with me, let's get the job done, right? It's
vengeful. There's a darkness to it.
Yes, he's not screaming, but it's angry. We destroy them all. And I'm gonna come back to this note in a second. The other thing that strikes me about this final panel, and I've always liked it when an X-Men story ends and at the bottom right of the last panel, there's a little X-Men symbol.
Right.
I think I've known some people who either don't like that or don't think it's necessary, that sort of the story itself should be apparent, or maybe they would rather a little box with the word end or the end. And I was sort of expecting a little, you know, the capital letter D from the logo for Duke, or a little Energon Universe logo on the bottom right. And then for a quarter of a second, I thought, wait, is this a 6-issue miniseries? Is there more? And I'm not so simple that I need a symbol or the word at the end to tell me it's the end. I know from context, it's the end. But of course, it's really just the beginning.
That could be something I've seen before, the end, or is it just the beginning?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so to get back to this vengeful note, something that I know has informed this whole miniseries, and I think briefly occurred to me in issue 1 or 2, but really occurred to me here in reading issue 5, on page 11. Page 11, if you're holding the comic, it's a left page. It's got 5 panels, and it alternates between Duke smashing the bat with its spinal column and its head like a swinging mace, like a morning star, and 2 flashback panels of Starscream. And sort of using his hands to clap the jet, killing Frost, and then also backlit by the sun, smiling with evil eyes, but and backlit and therefore sort of in shadow, as this like terrifying, giant, menacing, mysterious, unknown something, right? And this page is all done with sort of reds and yellows, and the sound effect on the final panel, smash, and Duke's gritted teeth and his clenched brow and his closed eyes. And again, I know this has been apparent, but it really hit me when I read this. Oh, Duke has PTSD.
Mm.
And he is working through something here. And I think it's offering him some temporary relief. And if this adrenaline rush saves his life because he can get the bat and the bat won't kill him and Duke can fight on for a few more pages, great. But I had forgotten how horrifying it would be to not just lose his friend, not just have his jet swatted away by something, not even the sort of feeling his back turned, feeling that his government, that Hawk had turned their back, he couldn't be believed, he's on the run. Jeez, it really piles on. Just the horror of seeing what we know is Starscream and being helpless. And I thought, what an intense page, writing, composition, drawing, color, lettering. And then 2 panels later, he's starting to get up and his word balloon is wobbly and the font is a little bit smaller. And he says, I did it, over the like dead bat. And that's really fun and satisfying. I feel like if this was a movie, this might be the moment where people in the audience sort of like cheer, but it's also upsetting, you know, and worrisome. Like, oh, are you okay? No, he's not. And then, but he's got to keep going because, you know, the base is going to blow up. And then, so I found that page really effective.
Yeah, and as a sequence, you know, a lot of this issue five, is really defined by this battle with the bat, which is, you know, borne out by the covers. And it is rare in comics that you kind of see that one-on-one kind of fight, really, sort of just, you know, in those kind of beat by beat terms, that physicality of this, you know, this is this action, which is followed by this, you know, action. And it is very much like, you know, Duke is thrown to the, you know, to the ground. He's getting up again. He's hitting the bat in the chest, then hit back down again. The bat is changing its attachment, ready for the next maneuver. He's grabbing a gun off from this broken crate that's been exposed, pulling the trigger. It's empty, but, you know, swinging it, ducking the fire from its new extension, breaking the you know, the rifle against the bat's head, jumping on the bat, you know, across several panels, sort of climbing up on his back, ripping at the head and sort of pulling, detaching the head, and then sort of you know jumping, using it like a mace, as you know, sort of that beat by beat, move by move. Rather than just very broad, generic strokes, it's really choreographed in a very clear and compelling way.
Don't forget that also the 2 pages of him headbutting Destro, leading up to that's in the middle of the fight with the bat. You make a good point that this very choreographed, purposeful, and specific fight, it's just a guy and another guy, a robot. We don't see a lot of this in comics. And, you know, like Batman might fight a criminal in the streets of Gotham City. The Punisher might, you know, have this kind of fight with a character. But I feel like a lot of comics, sort of the story starts to, as you alluded to, the sort of fight choreography starts to sort of speed up and become maybe highlights, or it quickly escalates to powers and weapons. And this is so much about Duke's indomitable spirit and sort of, it's like, well, what can he tear? What can he use? He can, the gun's empty. The 1982 Cobra Soldier machine gun.
Dragunov sniper rifle. Yeah.
Thank you. The second G.I. Joe action figure I ever bought. Duke gets it. It has no ammo, so he's just going to use it to bash it. He can't. And then the thing with the head, and like, what an amazing panel. What an amazing page showing Duke full body standing on top of the bat's shoulders, right? What a skinny vertical panel to accentuate the vertical action of pulling the head off with this entire electronic spinal column after 3 panels of setting it up, of jumping onto its shoulders, mm-hmm. of kneeling down, grabbing, starting to pull, right? The sound effects are great. KKZZZ, TTTT, TRSH, take that, you stupid robot. And the comparison might be in the Larry Hama IDW Real American Hero and in some brand new Skybound ones, Joes versus Blue Ninjas, right? Where we see Joes fighting unstoppable robots, and how hard is it portrayed? What are the means by which the heroes do dispatch the robots? What are the losses or the sort of wounds that the Joes suffer? You know, it's not a fair comparison because this is one bat in half an issue. It gets a lot of real estate. And when Hama's writing this kind of fight over many issues, it's often like one Blue Ninja and 5 Joes, or like 5 Blue Ninja and 5 Joe Ninja. So it's not quite a comparison, but it's a comparison. And what's, I think part of the subtext here, what we're both saying, is that this adds to this idea that this miniseries introduces each character carefully and purposefully and gives them a few pages, if not a whole miniseries, to shine, right? When we saw Destro in issue 1, it was issue 1, right? Where he's sitting,
yeah. mm-hmm.
but you can't see him. I didn't think that they were going to wait all the way until issue 5 to show his face. Makes perfect sense. And even though we know who it is, and even though we know what's being done, they're just showing the back of him, or he's in silhouette, or his chin, or like a little bit of his head with a reflection on it. They're not doing a regular front shot, right? They're waiting, right? They're extending the anticipation so that it'll be more satisfying, right? Delayed gratification.
And when they do show him after teasing, you know, showing bits of him here and there, or slightly obscured views of Destro, it is a full page splash of Destro towering over Duke, adjusting his cufflinks with his black shirt almost down to his midriff, but not in his Destro iconic costume. He is in a kind of maroon or burgundy coloured suit with a leopard print lining.
So the leopard print lining, of course, everyone, is a small nod to Prophet Director Destro, to a proposed action figure repaint from many years ago that was nicknamed by fans Pimp Daddy Destro, where this crazy leopard print was on the outside. And now every time a Destro figure gets released, there's going to be a recolor. It's this costume for Destro, separate from the leopard prints. I mean the red, and I want to say this as someone who has a sports blazer with a very cool lining.
Okay,
I have a black, my suit, my black sports blazer looks like a normal sports blazer on the outside. The lining is like red silk with a sort of a pattern, and you know you can't see it, right? So only I know it's there. Anyway, back to Destro. I think we sometimes forget just how outlandish and sort of fantasy, a little bit of sci-fi, super villain comic book, flamboyant Cobra costumes are in G.I. Joe, right? Like, I look at Dr. Mindbender and I don't bat an eye, but I could show a drawing of Dr. Mindbender to like my cousin or my aunt, and it's like a Flash Gordon villain. Well, he's got a twirly mustache. He's bald, monocle. He's got a metal crotch piece, purple pants, knee-high boots, suspenders, a cape, right? Gloves, on and on and on. And I think partly because the original Destro figure, the proportion and the sculpt is so muted, and also because we're so used to it, right? You're a kid, you watch the cartoon, he laughs, right? But it's like, no, he's got an open shirt and a crazy red collar and like superhero boots. And it's like this for all the Serpentor, Zartan, it's just on and on. And it's amazing. It's amazing, right? Ron Rudat did such wonderful work and got such wonderful notes from the team at Hasbro in the 80s that sometimes you have to see the other costume, the alternate. Well, what's Destro wearing when he's not wearing his flamboyant supervillain battle togs? Well, he's wearing a jacket and slacks, right? And it's like the color does so much here, right? Well, it's red. Not because it's fun and it's Destro, yes. Because he's a flamboyant supervillain, right? He's got like mansions and castles in the mountains, and he's, you know, like, he's a rich, crazy jerk. And, like, think of rich, crazy jerks in the real world. Like, you know, people who run companies, big companies in the world right now. Like, they're not like us. They've got, I don't know, like, three swimming pools next to each other, right? Or, you know, like, their TVs are the size of a wall. Or, you know, someone has to walk their elephant, right? Like, walk my dog, walk the elephant, right? And so Destro gets this costume change, which I loved. I just loved. So you turn the page and it's not just the reveal of the Destro from issue 1 in the costume we know and love. It's in a costume that reinforces sort of who he is and the flamboyant costuming of Cobra. But also this is like, it sort of pushes the delayed gratification even one step further. Like, well, you're not going to get to see him full from a front view in his regular costume until the cover to Destro number 1. Which is coming next.
And he's got some great dialogue as well, has Destro.
The speech.
In all wars, there's only one winner. The weapons and those that control them. The red in red, white, and blue is made from your blood.
Etc. Great dialogue there from Williamson for Destro.
That's one of my notes. Issue number 5. Good Destro speech, pages 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I've pointed out when a comic or a scene is too wordy, and sometimes it's great because something awesome is being explained, or maybe that's the only reason. I don't know. Or the last couple of pages have been wordless, mm-hmm. and now I appreciate the contrast. And, man, I don't know how to write dialogue for comics. I don't do that. And I feel like if I did, it would be too wordy and too long, and the editor would say, shorten this by 75%.
See, there's a good balance, I think, just generally from Williamson's writing about having an appropriate amount of words, dialogue on the page. Often relatively minimal, where there doesn't need to be words. He won't necessarily use them or use very many. And when someone is speechifying, it's not overwhelming. I did have one note where someone talking picked up on it as an interesting approach. And that was where Duke is talking to himself in issue 4 when he's in the Sky Striker. There's that sequence where he's in the Sky Striker and he says, at least the bleeding stopped. Okay, the device that Burkhart gave me was confiscated when Rock and Roll and Stalker got me. So this might be a shot in the dark. I think this is it. Could be nothing down there, but for Frost, I got to find out. The world needs to know what really happened to you. I need to know why they lied to your family, why they lied to me. And, you know, maybe in film, it might be narration. In a typical comic, maybe there might be a bit more caption boxes, but he's talking to himself. It's exposition, and there's enough dialogue there that he's, you know, giving a little bit of explaining to the audience as to what he's doing, what his motivation is, explaining away a bit of a, you know, no prizing in real time, a little bit of a question that might come up about how is he, you know, able to track Destro's base. So it all works, but it did strike me as that's Duke talking himself quite a lot.
I think a small solution could be to just turn these into thought balloons. And I feel like a lot of comics in the last 10 or 20 years have moved away from word balloons, either in favor of narration boxes or just not. Or if the writer is a little stuck, having someone say aloud to someone else. In a scene like this, it's not going to work. Unless he's like recording, you know, like I'm doing this voice memo in case I don't come back and you know why I did this. That'd be nice. I would be fine if it was just thought balloons. I think
he's just on this last panel there. He says, I need to know why they lied to your family, why they lied to me. So he's almost talking with an invisible Frost. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's all good and it works. I think that top panel, at least the bleeding stopped, I think those two word balloons could be thought balloons. I think there's this like subtle allergy to thought balloons because they look...
Isn't done. It's taboo almost.
They visually look, I'm doing finger quotes here, air quotes. They look cartoony. Mm-hmm. They look not serious. They draw attention to themselves in a way that an elegant, perfect computer-drawn ellipse, an oval for a word balloon or a rectangle for a narration doesn't. They look like comics. And this sure is a comic, but I think in that way, a lot of comics still don't want to look like comics. I wanted to point out, so we've talked a lot about issue 5, and I wanted to point out 2 or 3 things in issue 4 that the opening... the fight, that the bloodhounds are still there, that the Baroness has just betrayed or surprised Duke, and how he sort of talks her out of it. We haven't referred to that. It's great. There's a lot of tension here. And it's a really good pickup from how issue 3 ended, where she shoots him in the leg and says, I'm going to turn you in for the bounty, fool. But like on page 2 in the middle, look at his subtle scowl when he's looking right at her gun. And then in the panel below it, such great storytelling and design. This is page 2 of Duke number 4, where there are these 3 black shapes in the background for, I don't know if it's jail cells or like garage doors, but these three black sort of doorway hallway openings. And Rock and Roll and Clutch, one of them is successfully fighting a bloodhound, one of them is not. And then the Baroness gets one offset, and then Duke gets one, which allows Baroness and Duke to be silhouettes, negative space silhouettes in front of black, right? What an elegant solution to, not even a problem, just what an elegant choice. And then the next page, right? Like, I don't really buy original art anymore, and I don't buy original art in the era of computer lettering, because I really want original art to have the word balloons on it. To me, that's part of it. And this page is sort of one of those like curveball pages where I thought, would I want to buy this page? Because it's so unusual. But look at the sort of rhythm where Rock and Roll gets a panel on the offense. Duke gets a panel to talk the Baroness down. Clutch gets a panel where he's on the defense. And it keeps switching back and forth. It's like A, B, A, C, A, B, A, C, right? So Rock and Roll, Duke, Clutch, Duke, Rock and Roll, Duke, Clutch, Duke. And the colors are subtly different for these sort of these two different kinds of scenes, Duke versus Baroness, and then the other two guys fighting. And Tom Riley does something subtle with his inking where Rock and Roll and Clutch in their fight, they're underlit. They have all these heavy shadows on the tops of their arms and noses and heads. And then each one sort of turns where Rock and Roll punches a guy, but then gets punched in the nose. And then he slams that guy's head down on a rock, right? So it's sort of like ABA. And then offense, defense, offense. And then Clutch, his build sort of more traditionally where he's getting strangled, he's reaching for a rock. And then in that final middle panel, he hits the bloodhound in the face. And kind of just like a little bit like the Scrap Iron throwing the helmet, you see it, but you don't see it, right? You see sort of the moment after here where it's the bloodhound's goggles that are flying in the air. It's the bloodhound's hand that's released its grip. You see Clutch's fist holding the rock, but it's a moment after and the bloodhound's head is already jerked back from the impact. And then this ends with this great line of Duke's, right? Like, help or don't, shoot me or don't. And it's what you were saying about Williamson's writing, there's a nice combination of action and dialogue. Things are peppy, but also sort of meaty and satisfying. I feel like it's modern comics where things skip along, but it's not so modern that it's like, this issue, I read it in 2 minutes, you know? Like, it was just a lot of big art with no dialogue. Okay, so then two wonderful sort of fan moments where two or three pages later, they get to the armory in the pit, turn on the lights, and we see, are these Maulers, right?
It's certainly the one closest to us is a Mobat.
Okay. Yes, thank you. We see a bunch of G.I. Joe vehicles that are recognizably not like invented 2024 vehicles or generic army vehicles. And it's like, yeah, you know, vehicles. It's like, no, these are, to you and me, 80s G.I. Joe vehicles. And there starts to be this bigger sort of meta link that Joshua Williamson is doing where the story takes place now in 2023. But in a previous issue, the pit is referred to as something from the past that was decommissioned, and now we have these old vehicles, right? And so then you get to this really fun page turn, double page spread where these four proto Joes on the run zoom out at us in this like fun, not quite realistic way. You know, like I don't think you'd have a jet and a tank and an armored personnel carrier all coming out of this like wide opening at the same time, you know, within 20 feet of each other. Like, that's not safe. You know, it's like you know the movie Armageddon, they launch two space shuttles at the same time. Can't do that. You cannot do that. We cannot do that. We don't have the ability. But this is such a, it's like, no, I'll go with it here because it's such a fun, I don't want to say fan moment because That's a little bit of a diminutive, but it is a fan moment. I'm like, I just laughed out loud and thought, yeah. And then you have this nice parallel where the pages are symmetrical. You have this circular inset panel on the left, Blood and some bad guys reacting negatively, and then a similar panel on the right, and Clutch, you know, having his like, oh yeah, moment. And then a page of mayhem. And it is so satisfying to see a Sky Striker, the Sky Striker. It's so satisfying to see the Baroness get away in a fang. And did we see the fangs in issue 3 when the Bloodhounds show up?
I don't know that we saw it in issue 3, in issue 4, where the Mobat is introduced in that big garage. The bottom panel in that sort of ready orange colouring. Top left, there is a fang on the ground.
Okay, yeah. It's all right. I see a bunch of Bloodhounds and two Aspids, and then yes, one. And there's a nice, you know, one of the things we've talked about with Larry Hama's writing, and also the couple of issues that he's written and drawn, introduce and reintroduce, establish and reestablish.
Oh, I'll point out as well, we also saw the fang introduced in that big hangar that when Duke was back snooping at the, yeah, back in issue 1 when he was snooping at Destro's Mars Industry.
And that's when we had described it as more of that 4-inch redesign fang.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
like
yeah.
2 years ago. Because there is no classified fang, right?
Not yet. No classified.
Okay. We assume there'll be one.
Yeah, there'll have to be one eventually, won't there? Okay.
I haven't talked about Jordi Belair in 30 or 40 minutes. There are so many. Oh, this whole issue is seemingly colored with 13 colors, right? Any one scene has 3 or 4 colors. And it is such a good fit for Tom Riley's art. It's so clear when you change location from inside to outside, or top level to lower level, or bad guy base to good guy fleeing in a jet, you know, at nighttime, right? That scene that you talked about where Duke's talking to himself, it's just all blue. But there's a lot of subtlety in there, and it's not all blue. You know, the scene where the mayhem, where the four Joes bash and crash into all the Bloodhounds, and then Baroness gets away, and then Duke gets away. You know, it's all kind of 3 colors. And yet there's some big chunks of negative space background white left sort of open and to just punctuate like another hit, or like what a beautiful silhouette in the final panel of that scene after Clutch salutes Duke and Duke's jet has taken off, and it's just a blacked out Sky Striker in front of this orange circular, but it's got texture and dots. That's the sun, right? Not the moon. Man, gorgeous.
a quick fact check on something you said earlier. You mentioned that a Baroness had shot Duke in the leg in issue 3. It was actually Blood had shot him in the leg before he got an eyeball. It was Baroness that actually shot Blood in the back of the head and then leveled the gun at Duke. So it's a slightly different dynamic, I think, rather than Baroness having already shot Duke.
Right, thank you.
I think there's more ambiguity as to
your little bit of sort of scripting and dialogue about is Duke talking to himself too much. My version of that is after Duke has been shot in the leg and he convinces Baroness not to do additional harm, she says, "How is your leg?" Duke says, "As long as I don't put any weight on it or try to walk, I think I'll be fine." And then he continues, "I can definitely walk with you. I can definitely go down this long ladder, walk down a long hallway, climb up a ladder, get into a jet, fly the jet for 6 hours, and then walk and climb through a robot factory, and then take out a robot, and then I'll like die happy. Mm-hmm. Just for the next couple of seconds, I can't walk or put."
But when he's in the jet just a few minutes later, he says, "At least the bleeding stopped." I'm not sure that's how a bullet wound to the leg works, but...
I mean, that's certainly how bullet wounds in TV and movies and comics work. You know, like they're all, quote, just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
And someone like... I watched an exciting Marvel show last night and someone has a bullet wound and they're like grunting and they lean against a wall and they lift up their shirt or their jacket. And there's, you know, like the prosthetic stuff with like wounded flesh and like sort of a circle where there's a wound. And in the timing of the scene, I don't know if the bullet happened, you know, 2 minutes ago or 3 hours ago, but it's like, there's no bandage. There's no tourniquets. There's no like sewing it up. That would just still be bleeding. I think that's how that works. You know, it's like, there's a reason why real doctors and nurses or EMTs say to you, like, apply pressure with this gauze or shirt or whatever. It's like, no, you need the blood to clot so it stops bleeding. So
I sometimes think about the TV series 24 with Kiefer Sutherland, which is meant to be, you know, set during 24 hours, like real time. And he often goes through some serious trauma during the events of the series. And typically the repercussions of whatever has happened to him might last him the episode, but the next one, generally, he's pretty much back to normal, because while it's set in real time for him, a week has passed in our lives and we've probably forgotten exactly the horrendous thing that happened to him the previous week.
The writers, producers, the actors, you know, it's like, well, he got shot or punched really, really hard in episode 3. And now in episode 12, it's 10 hours later and a real person would still be limping or like holding their side and grunting. It's like, no, we don't want to do that for that long. My favorite example of this is Nicolas Cage's character in the Simon West film Con Air at the end, when he's just walking towards the camera during the big fight at the end and just a bullet goes through his arm and just keeps walking. And I think he like slightly sort of blinks or sort of fidgets from the tiny impact. But it's like, yep, that's a Superman. Okay, so despite the fact that I've spent a couple minutes on this, I totally accept Joshua Williamson's sliding scale of injury and recovery, because A, everyone else does it, and B, I do want the story to move along, and I don't need Duke to like actually limp for 5 pages and slow down and then the other Joes have to abandon him. Like, he needs to get to the jet and go to Destro's place. And lastly, Williamson does try to, you know, there is an acknowledgement, I can't walk on it. And then he does get to sit in a plane for a while. And then he does have a bandage on his leg.
I don't know that piloting, you know, one of these F-14 jets is a kind of relaxing recuperate from the previous experience type.
It's funny you say that, because I think my brother, when we were younger, read a lot of books and magazines on jets and the jet age and jet pilots. And he said to me once, fighter jet pilot is the hardest job in the world, because you have to be physically fit, you have to have an advanced degree, you have to be able to think on 3 axes, you have to use the joystick and the throttle, you're worrying about, you know, an enemy that you can't see that might be behind you or flying out of the sun. There's the physical stuff of G-forces. Stuff is like loud and muffled at the same time because your helmet and the radio, you're in this tiny, tiny space. You have to do all this math for calculating and on, right? And missiles and distances and fuel and all and on. So you're right. It's not like Duke pushes a button and it's autopilot. It's like, I'm going to take a nap while we fly to Duke.
Just rest up while
Despite all of this, I still think it's not, and there's no points off for this in my Yo-Jo-age score.
Yeah.
Right?
We're allowed to live in a comics world to some degree. And also I think, you know, he's on adrenaline and he's been beaten up and it's acknowledged. And I think he's on vapors here and he wants to get to the end of his mission. And once he's defeated that bat, which is kind of, he's treating almost like that's, you know, his main accomplishment. He's done what he needs to do. He's sort of, you know, using that point to sort of lie down and kind of.
Now I can sleep. Thank you for reminding me of the bat fight. This is where if Joshua Williamson had, and he doesn't start to lose me, but if he had started to lose me because of this stuff about the injury, he would win me back, because the bat fight is so satisfying and visceral. And I do feel like Duke is coming into it only at half speed. So he sort of earns it back if there was any problem. One last thing I want to point out that's just great about visual storytelling and art on pages, we're in issue four. Page 18, it's on the left side. There's just a really nice diagonal to this whole page where in the top panel, we see the opening in the wall and it's center left. And then the inset second panel, Duke's fingers, his hand coming over the ledge, moves a little bit further to the right. And then the next panel, he's like steaming or smoking. Cool. From the crash that he just survived.
From his crash, yeah.
And then his sort of shoulders and head are a little further to the right again. And then even though on the next panel, I think you're supposed to see him and read his word balloons first, the sort of diagonal down line from the top opening to the hand to his head continues with the his tanks. And then in the final panel, this concentric circles, and you sort of sweep back over to him. So I sort of read this page like the letter J. I like that. It's just a nice sort of leading your eye exercise from Tom Riley. And then on the opposing page, again, you have some sort of, to use a film term, cross-cutting, where first panel, just geometric shape, although I know what it is because I saw the cover of the issue. It's just all dark with a little bit of light on something. So something mysterious, and then you see Duke. And then again, on the left side, something mysterious. It's the bat's chest illuminating, turning on, powering up, right? And then the next page, you know, Duke continues his search through all these interesting compositional shapes, these crates and doors. And he doesn't realize that in this fourth panel on the page, we're in the room with the bat. The bat's now us. We're about to go out toward him. And then in the next panel, right, I'm killing your flying robot, he screams. And the background drops out, not because the lights go out, not because Duke has sort of stepped into a closet, but because the storytelling sort of mentally needs to drop out the background, that we're just in Duke's head, his rage, so that when we close in on his head, his neck with the bat's claw, it's as big a surprise to him as it is sort of visually to us. And this is just a basic six panel page with six equally sized square, they might be slightly rectangular, but let's say square panels, just another, and you know, then you turn the page, it's like, oh no. And you know, I've read a lot of G.I. Joe comics, and I have not encountered sort of as simple and yet as high stakes and satisfying a cliffhanger as this one. Like, oh, he's just been shot and beaten up and crashed a plane and this killer robot. Like, no, I saw Arise Serpentor Arise part one, right? It took Sergeant Slaughter to take out all those bats. The Joes couldn't take out all those bats. And here's this bat, right? And this very cool, like, black and white diagonal. What a cool, I don't want to reduce the price on these comics at my store. I want to continue to sell them for cover price. But, you know, I think when the graphic novel collection of this miniseries comes out, you know, down the line, people aren't going to be wanting these issues at cover price. You know, maybe they go in the back issue bin marked up a little bit. Certainly we've got a couple of variants like that, but it's also fun to sort of fantasize like, oh, could I put these five issues in a bag and mark it down a little bit? Again, folks, please don't come to my store in April of 2024 expecting a deal on the Duke miniseries. But what a satisfying read. Wouldn't it be fun once we've sold most of our copies, you know, made our money back, to discount the price on this as an entree to the Energon universe in a way that, you know, maybe Void rivals Volume 1. That scratches a very different itch. You know, are you a lapsed G.I. Joe fan? Oh, you excited that Hama's back, but, you know, issue 306 is still sort of an intimidating tall order. Well, here's a miniseries with that guy you know.
And thankfully, it's just about as good as G.I. Joe comics get. Looking at this, you know, splash page with the bat being introduced, I did note to myself that definitely Classified is the kind of the visual influence for the look of the Energon universe, but it's not a sort of slavish kind of look, that there can be differences. Like Duke in the pages of this miniseries does not look like any toy that has been produced. The likes of Stalker, for example, is very, very, very close to the model used for Classified. But there are slight differences, like he had that knife on his back that he uses in issue 4, and that isn't a part of the Classified design. It's a kind of a nice touch. And the bat itself is different to the Classified design. The Classified design of the bat is used on Duke issue 5, that variant D by Brian Level. That what has been drawn there is basically the Classified bat, and that is the same design that appears in the preview that we've seen for Destro 1. The bat here that we're seeing is a new sort of bat that is, you know, pulling cues, but is different to the bats of the Classified, or indeed any other G.I. Joe toys. And I guess storytelling logic for that is that this is a bit of a proto bat, that this is an early iteration of the bat, and before all of the final kinks have been worked out and it's kind of been put out as a more of a production line model, which is the one that sort of, you know, mass produced and becomes the de facto bat.
Yeah. I am slightly missing the bat's signature chest plate design, with that, you know, particular bit of, you know, aqua
circuitry, yeah,
red and yellow, yeah, circuitry. This looks a little bit more sort of, you know, Terminator, Transformers-y. But because we have already experienced the IDW G.I. Joe continuity written by Chuck Dixon, the comic that was just called G.I. Joe, that launched with issue 0 of G.I. Joe, where it was established real American hero characters, but in more realistic, modern than, you know, 2000 or was it 7, 8, 9, military gear and costumes. I'm okay. I'm very okay with characters having some differences and Classified being the starting point, but not the ultimate sort of endpoint. I also feel like if Tom Riley and other artists drawing these miniseries are making some changes, this doesn't feel like shortcuts, and this doesn't feel, this is a strong word, it's probably too strong, it doesn't feel disrespectful, like, no, I'll just sort of draw whatever I want. It feels like, I'm going to make a couple changes because it's a little faster, or maybe, as you said, it's like, not the bat, it's the proto-bat, or maybe Tom Riley thinks, like, you know, I think this sort of, like, yellow belt is a little, I can do something a little different. It's a little, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. Basically, the art here is so good that this small change feels like a very small compromise to live with, as opposed to such a drastic change that feels like it's getting something wrong. You know, like, you know, over in...
Yeah, I think there's an intent behind it. I think the easier option would have been to draw the standard figure design for it. So the reason that they're not is I think that, you know, speaking to the fact that it's an early bat, and the final bat is the one that comes next.
I mean, some of this is Tom Riley. Some of this, I'm looking at the final page of issue 4. Some of this, I think, is Jordi Belair, where, you know, I'm looking at a picture of the Classified bat right now, and it's the toy does have yellow boots, and yep. Tom Riley is drawing the metal part at the top of the boots, and then the sort of top metal part on the yellow part. I don't know what you call it—the part where you tie your shoelaces. That part, Belair, whether by choice or by oversight, is just making the boots light gray, not yellow and light gray. And this bat is so clearly a bat. I'm okay with it.
And the visor of the bat is red, like the cartoon, rather than silver, like the bat that appears on the cover, like the toy, or like the bat that appears in Destro number 1 preview. That's okay.
Yeah, and I have a feeling that this kind of thing will continue for every artist doing every G.I. Joe book in the Energon universe at Skybound. This is a hunch. This is not based on any evidence or any interview. I just sort of feel like artists are going to sort of do the classified stuff and then change 15% for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And Skybound and Hasbro are going to be okay with it. And me too.
We talked about the IDW continuity just a second ago, as written by Chuck Dixon. And in that continuity, to join the Joes, you had to be declared dead, effectively. So you had to leave behind your previous kind of civilian identity. And to all intents and purposes, your friends, your family, the world, you were dead so that you could operate in secret as part of the Joe team, which looks to be what is happening with Duke to some degree, that they're allowing him to be portrayed as dead for this news broadcast so that he can join the G.I. Joe team as a kind of more of a, what's the right word?
Even more disavowed.
But yeah, disavowed.
Or sort of preemptively disavowed.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, interesting carry across. I wonder if anything more gets made of that particular aspect.
Yeah, the comparison here is in the original cartoon, the Joes were top secret, but in the Deke episodes, they got a parade from the president. And in the Sunbow episodes, they're like brothers and cousins and nephews and nieces were kidnapped by Cobra and brainwashed. So the Joes had not been declared legally dead. And in the Devil's Due continuity, continuing from the Marvel run, they're made public, right? And Flint writes that book.
Yeah. And then they kind of walk back from that aspect a little bit.
And then in the Larry Hama continuity, his 300 issues, the comparison here isn't, you've been declared dead, now you can join the team. It's, oh, you won a medal. It's going into that vault in the Pentagon. And, you know, when you retire or die, we'll pull it out.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that they sort of, you know, are the forgotten. They, you know, what they do is either not referenced if it's good, or if it goes bad, that potentially they get thrown under the bus. Wrapping up just the last plot points of the issue, there's that bit where there's a bit of a reconciliation between Hawk and Duke, which I just wanted to touch on. And I think they handle that quite deftly, that there was we were a little bit worried that maybe Hawk might be sort of coming across badly in those first couple of issues. You know, is he going to be a bit of an antagonist to Duke? And I think that the kind of explanation that he gives Duke is quite satisfying, that he said that if, you know, I knew more than I was letting on, but if I gave you that truth, you weren't ready to deal with it. You'd be like a dog chasing a car. You know, that he's looking out for Duke almost by holding some of that stuff back. I like that he's coming from a place of trying to do the right thing. And that they do have this sort of decent reconciliation before the series is out.
Hmm.
I spy with my little eye.
Shall we talk to a couple of the I Spies, the Easter eggs in here that... the only one that we've not talked about is the Stinger showing up. With a modified missile rack, slightly different to the iconic Stinger. But beyond that thing, I've touched on everything that I noticed. There was a lot in the letters page. It's always quite interesting to pick the letters page and see what little details are in there. One of them was, we have a lot planned with Larry, so stay tuned for some big, capital big, news hitting soon. I don't know if that's the Chris Mooneyham work that they were talking about or something else, but whatever it is, big Larry Hammer news sounds good.
I hope it's more than just a special or a yearbook. I hope it's a couple of things. Because that word gets my hopes up.
They talk to the Transformers are still unknown to most of Earth's population. So when they show up outside their book, it should feel like a big deal. And I liked that. I liked the fact that, you know, this is mostly grounded and you know, Transformers isn't just going to be very blasé. Okay, the Transformers are going to join our team and we're going to hang out and drink coffee together. And it's going to, you know, they're going to be treated like any other regular part of our world. They are definitely the other at this point in time. That made me think as well about the bigger connecting story here going on. They talk a little bit about Void Rivals being separate, but eventually sort of being a bit more connected down the line. And the obvious bit of the bigger connecting story here is kind of Destro needing a better power source for his fleet of vehicles. And then that sort of search for a power source being a main driving force for Cobra Commander. So I think we can expect kind of those connecting threads to come together in Cobra Commander 5, the Destro needing a power source and Cobra Commander having one.
Something that I'm aware of reading these early issues of all four series is how fun it is to be at the beginning when things are going right. And when a character shows up for the first time again, it's fun and exciting, or, you know, a vehicle or someone, you know, does something that we've been waiting to see, you know, someone betrays someone or someone uses a cool weapon. And I don't think I'm a negative person, but I've also had this counter thought, which is, well, what might it feel like in a year or two when the Void Rivals characters are, you know, conquering Washington, D.C., and G.I. Joe's there. And I do trust that whatever is going to happen is going to go well. You know, like, it's like how you might feel about the first, whatever your first episodes of G.I. Joe are, the first miniseries, the first two miniseries, you know, the regular season, the Sunbow episodes versus the Deke episodes, you know, how you might feel about the original toys. I know that some people, like G.I. Joe really is 82 to 86 or 82 to 88. But of course, you know, fans came in a few years later, and for them, G.I. Joe is late 80s, early 90s, you know, or came in even later and it's like 25th anniversary. But I keep having this feeling, it's slightly cautious worry. Like, it's so exciting now when it's new and they've got all these great creators and it's small, and they're starting, and I hope it doesn't get out of scale, and I hope it doesn't happen fast, because, you know, I've said a version of this before. G.I. Joe can work in a universe with Transformers. They're doing it right now, but it's barely started, and G.I. Joe is on a human scale, and Transformers, the characters, are as well, but the stories are not. And then you have this X factor in Void Rivals. And I'm, you know, looking forward to and sort of biting my fingernails about a year or two from now when, because they keep saying like, yep, they'll meet, there'll be crossovers or something. And it's like, you know, the first 12 issues of Marvel G.I. Joe have a certain feeling because it's just the original Joes. And things feel different around issue 11 or 12 when, you know, Gung Ho and Doc and who? Torpedo.
The cast almost doubles in space of one issue. Yeah.
And on the one hand, that's awesome. We're on our way. And on the other hand, like, well, things were streamlined. And it's like, I was just getting to know those guys. So, you know, I can't wish that like the Duke miniseries was 40 issues and that Tom Riley and Jordy Belair would stick around for the whole thing. That's impossible and doesn't work. But I do wonder if in a year or two from now, I'll look back at this era and feel wistful.
Mm. They talk about what's to come a little bit. Joshua Williamson says, this really is just the beginning. We're just getting started on our massive Energon universe. It's only going to get more nuts from here. And then my hope is to get as many of these characters into the Energon universe as we can. I agree that G.I. Joe's vast and diverse cast has always been one of its strengths. So there's the strength of its big cast, but also to some degree its weakness, that you know, those characters can get lost in such a big cast. But you know, the language that Joshua Williamson is using, if there was any doubt in anyone's mind, he is talking to the long game here, and I really do think that he's gonna be sticking around in the G.I. Joe world, even if he's not going to be writing absolutely every mini.
Yeah, it sounds like, I don't know if it's a 2-year plan or a 4-year plan, and of course, you know, 6 months from now, someone may have a great idea, or the comics market might suggest adding something or changing something. So the multi-year plan will organically change. I do have an optimistic sense that Skybound has a plan, has a good plan, Hasbro's on board, and will continue to put good talent on it. So if I'm biting my fingernails a little bit, you know, it's like, oh, but the aliens. And again, I love Transformers, and I've liked Void Rivals so far. And I'm totally in on this new take on G.I. Joe, where they bump into alien robots. But if there's a story coming up, you know, like earlier I referred to when the one monthly Transformers comic, which was written by Mike Costa, when it ended and split into two monthly Transformers books written and drawn by other people, and the story continued. Those books did their own thing. And then 2.5 years in, they came together for a crossover. And that was really cool. But it was also like, okay, everyone, stop what you're doing over there. Stop what you're doing over here. Yeah. We have to come together for a crossover. And then at the end of the crossover, they each went back to their things. A third series started, and there was this slightly different status quo. And it was all really good and entertaining. I think the thing that I'm sort of specifically concerned about is, once the Transformers and maybe the Void Rivals aliens are much more everyday occurrences in the world of G.I. Joe, I don't want the Joes, like, in every issue of a G.I. Joe comic, like, driving and flying Transformers. I want them to drive and fly their own vehicles. And, you know, you made a reference a few minutes ago about, like, the Joes, what, like, would you say chowing down or just hanging out with some Transformers? Yeah. So I don't know how to phrase this other than I get that it's a shared universe. I've loved the little points of intersection so far. It should continue to be a shared universe, and I look forward to more connections in the future. But G.I. Joe should remain, to a great extent, its own thing. And I don't quite know how to do that when it's like something big is coming. They'll definitely meet the aliens, sort of, maybe, somehow. So, excited, optimistic, nervously optimistic.
Continuing on with the letter pages, shout out to friend of the show, Shane Simic, who has got a letter printed in issue 5. I don't know if that's his first letter or not, but congrats to Shane. Joshua Williamson talks a little bit about his approach to the characters that he's using in his storytelling, which is kind of what you'd expect, almost, that he's choosing between the you know, the most obvious and popular big characters, his childhood favorites, where the story is taking him, such as introducing Clutch, and then also just being inspired by, you know, what's going on around him in terms of the new toys being introduced by Classified and Hasbro. So probably what you'd expect, but good to hear a little bit about that process. And then they also trail the Energon Universe 2024 special, which is out either on Free Comic Book Day on the 4th, I think it is, May the 4th, that's right, or the retail version that comes out May the 8th, the following Wednesday. And that will answer the question, where is Baroness? It is crucial to the story we are building and takes place right after this issue. So definitely some momentum there. What comes next? The other I Spy I had was in the back of issue 4, where we had a preview for Creature for the Black Lagoon Lives, which is notable for a couple of things. Up to this point, we've only seen previews for other Energon Universe titles. This is a preview for a different Skybound title. So potentially, you know, trying to convert some G.I. Joe readers to wider expanding their reading. But secondly, it is written by Dan Waters, who also gets a preview of his next comic, Destro number 1, in the back of issue 5.
Yeah.
Quote of the week, quote of the week. Quote of the week, quote of the week.
Quote of the week, quote of the week.
Quote of the week.
There was lots of good dialogue. We've talked about some of it here. One of my favourite lines was from issue 4 between Duke and Stalker. Duke says, "At ease, Stalker, she's with me," talking about the Baroness. Stalker replies, "Considering we're in this mess because of you, that does not inspire me with confidence." Was there anything you wanted to shout out, Tim? Or?
Well, I liked Destro's speech and referred to that already. If we're talking about words specifically, it's fun to point out that the inside back cover of Duke number 5 is an ad for the opening release of Energon Universe graphic novel collections. Mm-hmm. So Void Rivals Volume 1, which is out now, Transformers 1 coming soon, Cover Commander 1 coming soon. And I don't think I'd quite tracked this yet, but the subtitle for the Duke Volume 1 miniseries, and it is called Duke Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
Its title is Knowing is Half the Battle, which is cute because, you know, Cobra Commander's Volume 1 subtitle is Determined to Rule the World. The Transformers subtitle is Robots in Disguise. The Void Rivals subtitle is More Than Meets the Eye. But it's cute because Duke is trying to figure out this conspiracy, this mystery, mm-hmm. in his miniseries. And the title of the overall arc gets to be Knowing is Half the Battle. He gets to know.
Good. Nice tying into those kind of classic phrases.
It's Yo Joeage time.
Yo Joeage is next. So, Tim?
9, 10? I don't know. It's really good.
Yeah. 9 or 10. I don't know if I've given a 10 before, but... Oof, you know, this is about as good as it gets, so why not? Let's give it a 10. Sort of with the whole series in mind as well. Really, really, really enjoyed Duke and what a great benchmark for the level of quality that we might expect from Skybound and the Energon Universe.
Postbox Pit, this is where you can send in your thoughts. Mark and Tim will hear it, and then we'll discuss it. It's really nice to hear from our biggest fans.
Yo, Talking Joe! Hello, Mark. Tim, gotta say, those last two episodes, issues of Duke... were wonderful. I love seeing Scrap Iron in all of his classified glory. The Baroness being the deceitful and self-motivated character she is. Clearly wasn't going to be Joe. And Major Blood is alive. So when can I expect a retraction from Screen Rant? Alive but lost an eye. Oh, and I just love that fight with the bat. Especially Duke performing Sub-Zero's fatality on the bat by ripping its head off with its spine and then beating it to nuts and bolts. Also Duke meeting Destro and headbutting him. That's gotta be painful. I'm excited for the future of G.I. Joe, especially with that tease involving Optimus Prime at the end and a Destro preview. I think Cobra Commander is set in that 6-month time window from Duke number 1, because Destro shows up in CC number 4, and Optimus has Megatron's arm. Well, now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
So next time on Talking Joe in the world of Energon Universe, we will be talking with the artist of this very series, Tom Riley. Then the Energon Universe special is out for Free Comic Book Day on the 4th of May. If you can make it down to your comic book shop to get a copy in hand, or the following Wednesday, the issue will also be released as a regular priced comic with variant covers, the variant introducing some new characters to the world of G.I. Joe. Cobra Commander concludes with issue 5 on the 15th of May. And this will be news to you, Tim. We will be talking to the artist Andrea Milana about their work on the book.
Cool.
G.I. Joe in the Energon Universe continues with Destro and Scarlet in Duke. We will cover those. And we already have the Scarlet writer, Kelly Thompson, with an agreement to talk to us. We will also be covering the latest issues of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, as they come out. Issue 306 will be out on the 15th of May. And we will be talking to new artist Paul Pelletier all about it. So if you counted on your fingers as they're going along there, that will be 4 G.I. Joe artists and writers who are lined up to talk to us in this new Skybound era.
Cool.
Tim, where can people find you when you're not talking to me about G.I. Joe?
Video essays on TV and film, youtube.com, at Atomic Abe. My brick and mortar comic shop is in Somerville, Massachusetts, Hub Comics, and I write about G.I. Joe online at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Very good. You can find out more about Talking Joe by visiting the website talkingjoe.co.uk, which has links to all the places where we are. We have a lively Facebook group that you can join. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We are also on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingjoe. And a big thanks to all of our backers, Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, Simon, and Chris, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. On occasion, I will also post unlocked content, so there is a free to subscribe option there to see that content as it is posted. So, Tim, I think that is us done. But remember that...
Nobody Beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Laters.